Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A newly created LGBTQ plus commission in Delaware prepares to get to work as the state recognizes Pride Month.
One of the amazing things about the team that the governor's put together here is, I mean, there is just such a wealth. There's really an embarrassment of wealth of resources on this commission.
We chat with the commission's chair, Cora Castle, about the issues the group hopes to tackle. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Arts Playlist offers a look at the Delaware Division of the Arts annual fellowship winners featured in its Award Winners 25 exhibition. And we bring you the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities People and Planet podcast. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. To kick off Pride Month, Governor Matt Meyer announced the individuals who will comprise a new 9-member LGBTQ plus commission to further the state's equity and inclusion efforts. The commission was created by then-Governor Bethany Hall Long by executive order in January. The first order of business Meyer tasked the group with is designing policies to ensure the safety and accessibility of relevant healthcare services for the state's LGBTQ plus community. Delaware Public Media's Sarah Petrowich sat down with the commission's newly appointed chair, Cora Castle, to discuss her vision for the group and what gaps need to be filled when it comes to resources for LGBTQ plus Delawareans.
So Cora, for starters, tell me a little bit about your background, particularly in the LGBTQ plus community, and what you think you'll bring to this brand new commission as its chair.
Yeah, I think one of the amazing things about the team that the governor's put together here is, I mean, there is just such a wealth. There's really an embarrassment of wealth of resources on this commission. You know, people across the spectrum, no pun intended. But I think one thing stands out to me as I look at the resumes of the folks on the commission. You know, there's clearly just an incredible wealth of people who have deep experience in advocacy for LGBTQ, and I also have some experience in that regard. But I think the thing that really stands out to me and why I think the governor selected me is because I am very broad, right? I have a large breadth of experience in various types of policy, not just advocacy policy. And also I have, one foot in, economic, making sure that we're, making sure that there's economic progress and making sure that we're doing things that are practical and useful for everyone. And of course, I am trans, and, I have a lot of experience working with our legislators and, doing everything that I can to, just personally, I have worked on legislation outside of any connection to any organizations with members of the legislative body. And so I think that I have a lot of initiative because I have done most of my advocacy work has been kind of solo, like lone wolf type stuff, just identifying things that need to be done, write a draft legislative package and knock on a legislator's door, right? So I really think that that is probably the biggest reason why the governor selected me to sort of run things.
Yeah, and going off of your lived experience a little bit, as we noted, this is the first commission of its kind in Delaware. So talk to me a little bit about why you think a commission like this is necessary, particularly in the first state, and what your vision is for this body moving forward.
Yeah, sort of in reverse. My vision is to make sure that every single Delawarean has the opportunity to participate in society, right? And to realize the benefits of the social contract, right? We all wake up, we go to work, we get paid. And for that, we expect to be afforded the opportunity to be productive members of society. And I think Delaware is a place. I'm very proud of Delaware. All of my friends who I know who live out of state, I always tell them, if you're looking for a place to move, come move to Delaware because I feel very safe here. But the fact is that there's still plenty of work to do. There's even in the most progressive states, there's still things that can be done. So I think there's a broad recognition that what we're trying to do here is, shore up our victories where we have them, make sure that they're locked in cement, and then also identify other areas where we can make even more progress, particularly with progress in the health sector, health and human services, ensuring that everyone in the community has proper access to all of the proper health tools that modern society provides us. And I think one of the things that is really important for the commission to do is look at the intersectionality, right, between a lot of the things that members of our community experience, and really understand how does this intersectionality produce outcomes that might not be so great for the community, and how do we prevent those intersectionality events from occurring so that we can sort of tackle people's issues sort of as they come.
Yeah, and I want to go back to a little bit about what you said about the healthcare policy, because that's actually, the first official task that Governor Meyer gave this board, designing policies to ensure the safety and accessibility of relevant healthcare services for Delaware's LGBTQ plus community. So talk a little bit more about why you think healthcare is such an important policy area to focus on when it comes to equity and inclusion for this community.
Yeah, so I can give you a very, very lived example. When I transitioned, I had to go to Philadelphia in order to receive proper health care. At the time, there were really no suitable, clinics or physicians in state that I could find, and I looked, who were very familiar with, the situations that I face, the conditions that I need to be concerned of and aware of, and the tests and things and medical procedures and things that are important for me. And so yeah, I mean, it was very, very difficult. I mean, every time I had to go to the doctor, I had to take a day off of work, right? It was just kind of a mess. So, the first thing is creating a culture where we attract physicians and healthcare providers who have experience dealing with LGBTQ plus patients, getting them to come to the state so that we can make it easier for members of the community to get to a physician. I think that's one of the main things. The elephant in the room, of course, is that there's significant threat from the federal executive. In an effort to reduce access to medical care for members of our community. And so, we have to counteract that by being extra vigilant in state. And I know that we can do that.
Yeah, that actually leads into kind of where I wanted to wrap up, which is just in a time of heightened political division following this most recent presidential election, are there any misconceptions you want to address about the work of a commission like this, or what you would say to those who may not see its value?
Yeah, I think I'll tell you, I was born in Delaware. I actually live in a building literally 3 blocks away from the building I was born in. So my house is 3 blocks away from the building I was born in. But I was raised in Texas. I was raised in Alaska. I was raised in Missouri. So my mom loved men in uniform, probably a few too many. But the point is, I have been all around, and I've also been to every single state in the country. And one of the things that I have realized is that we really have a lot more in common than we have in opposition to one another. And it's really unfortunate that there have that much political hay can be made by driving wedges between people. So I think that the direct answer to your question is, I really want to do everything that I can do to reassure all Delawareans, whether they're LGBTQ plus or not, that the purpose of our commission is to ensure that every single Delawarean has the opportunity to, again, participate in society, right, and receive the benefits of the social contract under which we all live.
Thanks to LGBTQ plus Commission Chair Cora Castle and our Sarah Petrowich for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us, Arts Playlist is next, with a look at the Delaware Division of the Arts annual fellowship winners featured in its Award Winners 25 exhibition. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. For decades, the Delaware Division of the Arts has been helping artists of all kinds practice their craft with yearly fellowships that provide some financial support. And this year marks the 25th annual showing of work from the current year's fellows. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny chats with Delaware Division of the Arts Program Officer for Artist Programs and Services, Roxanne Stanulis, about the fellowship and its impact.
Let me start by asking you about this year's fellowship recipients and the different artistic disciplines that are represented in this year's class.
We have visual artists. We have literary artists. We have a folk artist who does beadwork in an indigenous style. We have performers. We have an opera singer, some contemporary musicians. We have a very interesting music composer. And we have a choreographer who works with Indian traditional styles of dance.
I'm struck by how it's just such a really wide array of arts, kind of a holistic look at the art scene here in the state, I think.
Exactly. The fellowship program offers applications in 20 artistic disciplines. And that ranges from jazz to filmmakers, folk artists, as we mentioned, musicians, visual artists, and our writers.
How were this year's fellows chosen? What was the selection process like?
So the application is really focused on work samples. The applicant needs to show work from the last 3 years. For visual artists, that would be, if they're painters, they would submit 10 paintings, digital images. It's an online application. And there's also an artistic statement. Because this is an anonymous process, review process, there is not a lot of information shared with the jurors. So they read the artistic statement and then they look at the work samples. And the work samples vary based on the discipline. So for our writers, someone applying in fiction would submit 20 pages of writing. And our music performers are asked to submit 2 to 3 audio work samples. And those also need to be created within the last 3 years.
And there are different levels of fellowships. Can you talk me through those different levels?
Sure. We have an established fellowship, which is $8,000, an emerging fellowship, which is $5,000, and then a master's fellowship at $12,000. Artists can select which category between emerging and established. We'll talk about the master's in a minute because that is a little bit different. And if people have questions about which category they belong in, I will sort of help them work through that. And I usually advise artists to think about kind of what kind of recognition they've received, if they're getting national prizes, regional exhibitions, they might want to think about being in the established category. And then our master's fellowship is a little bit different. It's the highest honor that we have for our individual artists. And there is a significant waiting period. So to apply for the master's fellowship, artists need to have received an established fellowship. Then there's a 7-year waiting period. And then they wait for their discipline to be offered because it is a rotating cycle. We don't offer the master's fellowship in all 20 disciplines every year. And the master's fellowship is juried the same way, but they need to provide additional information. They need to include their CV in their application, as well as a master's narrative, which outlines their activity in Delaware, the impact of their work here, and just in a larger context.
And this year, the author, Viet Dinh, was the Master's Fellow. Can you tell me a little bit about him and his work?
Yeah, Viet's great. He came to our writers' retreat last year, so I got to know him a little bit better. But he's been involved with the division for a number of years. He is a fiction writer and instructor at University of Delaware, and he is, as I said, involved with the local community as well. And he's his list of accomplishments is very long, and list of prizes. So he was a perfect candidate for the Master's Fellowship.
There were nearly 200 applicants this year, is that right?
Yes, it was a record-breaking year. I can say I've been in the position for almost 10 years, and what I've seen is an increase in the number of applications, which has been fantastic. We're getting a lot more applications. We have been able to increase funding. This year, we were able to offer a $1,000 runners-up honorarium because we had so many applications. So that really shows that we're reaching new audiences, which is awesome.
We talked a little bit about the selection process, but what about for people who might want to apply for the next round of fellowships? What do they need to know?
So this is a long process. The application deadline is August 1st, and then notifications don't go out until December. Because we have to see what applications we get and in what disciplines, and then Mid-Atlantic Arts sort of finalizes the jurors. We do that together, and then the applications are juried in the fall. So it is a very streamlined process. You do need to register in our online system, and then there are a couple tabs to go through, but to prepare for an application, I really encourage people to think about the body of work that they want to present. The most successful applications really are sort of a cohesive body of work, either thematically for our visual artists, the 20 strongest pages of writing, your best audio sample, like the best quality that you have. And then to start thinking about a 350 word artistic statement that will help the juror understand your artistic practice, some of the things that have influenced your work, things that sort of help them understand what they're about to see.
Can you talk a little bit about why this program is important in the state's overall arts ecosystem?
The reason the fellowship is important is that it provides monetary support for artists, and it's also provides validation. I hear this a lot from the artists that it's sort of a turning point for them to have that external recognition. And then another benefit is the sort of camaraderie that you develop with your fellows during the year. So they get to know each other because they come to events, they perform together, and it really creates this really great climate for them. And it continues, and they want to keep sort of getting together, which is wonderful because I think for artists that's so important and noteworthy. We just had an artist who is a recent resident and just raving about the artistic community, how supportive it is. And we see that all the time.
And finally, this is just one of many ways the Division of Arts is supporting the state's creative community. Can you talk for a moment about some of the other things the division does?
Right. Well, I'll talk specifically about artist programs because we do have quite a few things. We have an artist roster, which is an online resource for artists and people looking for artists to connect. That is free for artists to apply. And if you're looking for an artist, it's a great place to find one because you can search by discipline. And then it will show you examples of their work. It will give you contact information with how to get in touch with them. So that's really a fantastic resource for artists here. We have occasional trainings, special trainings. We just finished a 2-day workshop with a financial expert who works with creatives, and that was really well received. In October, we're going to have our biannual art summit. We have one other grant program. The fellowship program is really the signature program. It's probably what we're best known for. The other opportunity we have is called an Artist Opportunity Grant, and that's a smaller grant, and that is for specific projects, programs, events, special opportunities that are going to advance an artist's career. Those have quarterly deadlines, so we have one coming up on July 1st. It is 80% of a project budget, up to $1,000. I should, if I can, say that the fellowship does come with requirement for fellows to do a public performance during the fellowship year. So for visual artists, we offer our mezzanine gallery for a solo exhibition. A lot of our literary artists will do readings in the community, and sometimes they team up and make it an event. So that's really great.
Thanks to Delaware Division of the Arts Program Officer for Artist Programs and Services, Roxanne Stanulis, and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. The award winner's 25 exhibition is on display at the Biggs Museum of American Art in Dover through September 14th, before moving to Odessa, then Rehoboth Beach this fall. And we wrap up The Green next with the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet, which focuses on the history, science, and cultural impact of oysters in the first state. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. We wrap up this edition of the show with the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. The podcast explores how Delawareans connect to the environments and cultures around them, and the cultural practices and creative works that bring us closer to the planet we call home. In this episode, we focus on Delaware and oysters. There was a long stretch of time in the past when oysters and aquaculture were a prominent part of the fabric of the first state economy and society. But a variety of factors led to oysters all but disappearing from the landscape, until efforts over the past 2 decades have led to something of a revival. On this episode of People and Planet, we explore the history, science, and economic and cultural impact of oysters in Delaware with Ed Hale, assistant professor in the School of Marine Science and Policy and the Delaware Sea Grant Program at the University of Delaware, and Morgan Krell, science technician at the Delaware Center for the Inland Bays. Ed, I want to start with you and just talk a little bit about the history of oysters in Delaware. Can you give us kind of a brief history in kind of what place oysters have had historically? Did it have, I guess, for example, like a heyday at some point economically and socially?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I would say that the peak of it was in the late 1800s in terms of its interest from a social and cultural perspective, but also from harvest. So in that period of time, commercial harvest would be up near 2.4 million bushels of oysters a year. An individual bushel might hold somewhere between 100 and 150 individuals. There would have been hundreds of schooners, which are sail-powered vessels, kind of sailing around Delaware Bay. A large part of that would have been centered somewhere around the Port Mahon, Bivalve, New Jersey area. So Port Mahon, Delaware, Bivalve, New Jersey. Shucking houses. There would have been oyster carts in the cities the way we have hot dog and pretzel carts now. So late 1800s to early 1900s really would have been kind of the heyday of oysters. They called the commodity white gold. There was actually a documentary about it, and really something pretty amazing back then, but definitely part of like Delaware social and cultural fabric, really formed an important part of our early development from a post-colonial development period.
How did things kind of progress into the 20th century, and at what point, I guess, did things start to tail off? Where did it kind of lose that cachet that it had built up?
Yeah, that's a great question. So from like the 1890s to the 1930s, landings of market oysters varied somewhere from 1.5 to 2.4 million bushels per year in Delaware Bay. both states. A large reduction in annual productivity kind of started around 1930 to 1940 of 1 to 1.5 million bushels per year. And the decline really started in earnest around 1940 in response to public concerns over issues associated with water quality standards. So oysters, of course, are one of the few foods that are consumed raw. And so, as you can imagine, as we developed water quality standards, particularly with sewage and open depositing and those kinds of things, we kind of learned about potential infections and issues. And so I'd say around 1940, there was a decline.
As we talk about that decline, like how steep did it wind up being? Was there a point where it was, you know, pretty much virtually disappearing from the landscape?
Yes, that's a great question. So landings, as I said, hit about 2 million bushels per year. They declined, started to decline in 1940, generally declined from 1962 to 1980, declined even further after the turn of the century. And current oyster harvest, wild harvest, the current quota is right around 14,000 bushels. So we've gone from, that's for the state of Delaware. So we've gone for, 2.4 million bushels, effectively two orders of magnitude reduction in harvest, really pretty substantial. Not all of that is associated with chemical pollution. We largely consider the late 1800s and early 1900s responsible for over-harvest. There was this kind of false belief that, you know, the seas were bountiful and you could just continually take things. We now know through the advent of modern management that that's not really how we want to manage natural resources. But also things like habitat degradation, poor water quality, as I mentioned, low dissolved oxygen, things that impaired other species as well hit oysters. And then in the 1950s through the 1990s, there was two what we call epizootic outbreaks. There was two protozoan parasites that infected oysters. These are not transmissible to humans as far as I'm aware, but they're diseases that crippled wild oyster abundance. And so we had this late 1800s period of overharvest. Then we stifled habitat, and so that further affected what we call recruitment of juvenile oysters and survival of the adults. And then we compound that with this oyster disease. And so really, we really hit the population pretty hard in a combination of ways.
Is it fair to say that there wasn't a whole lot maybe that could have been done at the time for some of these factors? And now that we have more knowledge, they become less of a factor?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can... just the management alone, if you look at the late 1800s into the early 1900s, this was a period of exploitation of natural resources that really crippled many different species that we interact with. Most of the species that we see are migratory fish species, right? And so we can extend this example out to other commercial fisheries, things like striped bass, well, a little bit less so striped bass, but definitely Atlantic sturgeon, American shad, some of our river herring species. So species that are known to occupy marine habitats then migrate into freshwater areas where they were more readily exploited, complements of their position alone associated with human inhabitation. So effectively, we were dropping populations at a really high rate. And then after 1950, a bunch of our commercial fisheries became industrialized with the advent of new technologies, right? Sonar, radar, complements of World War II, which were brilliant in terms of their wartime function and some of their scientific applications, but they made our fisheries even more effective at capturing animals. And I think that's what really drove the decline. And that, coupled with our lack of understanding of the potential regeneration times associated with what I would call modern natural resource management.
And I imagine all of that kind of really had a big impact on those local communities that for a long time it had this big local industry and almost a kind of societal, communal type of, you know, vibe around the oyster industry. To have that just kind of disappear had to leave a pretty big hole.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great point. And it's something that I like to talk about in like a fisheries management context. You can extend that out to past, like entire towns were built on oyster shells from shucking houses. You can look at, you can see shell middens deposited in New York and all over the place where we engaged in this activity. From Delaware Bay and from a Delaware Bay perspective, we have a more recent analog in weakfish. And so we can see like coastal towns develop over weakfish and they largely die. Effectively, the resiliency of the town was built on recreational fishing geared toward weakfish. We saw that Deneric reported they used to have dumpsters on site at public boat ramps in Delaware just for folks to throw out the weak fish they didn't want in the 1980s. And we saw towns pop up and towns collapse associated with this. And so I think that's a really salient kind of reminder about the potential impact of an explosive growth phase and kind of unregulated and unchecked. I think we need to be cognizant of that if we're going to think about long-term sustainability about some of our coastal communities.
And as we start looking at where things stand now with oysters, Ed, the industry started kind of making a comeback locally, 15, 20 years ago. Can you talk a little bit about what prompted that renewal and how much was it economics versus ecology or perhaps both?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tom. Really driven by both, in my opinion. There's a really cool case study of history within the state of Delaware. 1968, the state of Delaware, University of Delaware, wrote a book on the artificial propagation of oysters. 1980, we actually constructed a recirculating aquaculture lab to explore potential propagation of oysters. Along the similar timelines, Rutgers University, Horn Point at the University of Maryland, Virginia Institute of Marine Science, Forest College of William & Mary, and a couple of other places were exploring raw seawater oyster propagation. We had recirculating seawater, and so we were filtering it and treating it. And it turns out that the oysters consume so much phytoplankton that holding them for commercial propagation purposes in a recirculating environment is a bit more difficult. Because of this, some of our other coastal institutes developed pretty heavily. Definitely through the 1990s, we saw Rutgers and VIMS turning into like major powerhouses of oyster seed production. Consequently, their industry developed alongside of this. The University of Delaware kind of stepped away from the commercialization or the commercial production of oysters and delivery. And that's something that I'm very interested in trying to put back. I think, as we look toward this industry and just kind of noting some of the ecosystem benefits, both in terms of nutrient sequestration, water quality improvements, and habitat provisioning to juvenile fishes. It's one of these weird environmental things where we're actually beneficial. There was just a study released the other day that documented how oyster farming in Ireland is carbon neutral, in fact, beneficial. And so when you compare it to different crops and different crop diversity that we could grow, it's definitely something that we know has some pretty decent environmental benefits. And so it's something that I think we definitely need to kind of reinvest in.
Morgan Krell, this is where I want to bring you in. Morgan Krell with the Delaware Center for the Inland Bays. I want to bring you in here now because you're taking some of these things that Ed is talking about and applying them kind of practically in a project that you're working on, an oyster reef restoration project. So I want to get your perspective on how this is actually kind of playing out on the ground. And I guess first, tell us a little bit about this oyster reef restoration project that the Center for the Inland Bays is working on. Biggest in 30 years. Can you explain what it entails and what you're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, so I guess for a little bit of context, Ed was talking about Delaware Bay quite a bit there. So we only work in the three inland bays in southern Delaware, but many of those issues that he talked about in Delaware Bay apply here as well. The water mixes between our bays, and so the same diseases that are up there we were faced with here, and many of those same over-exploitation and water quality issues led to declines in our oyster populations as well. I do think that the inland bays actually maybe suffered an even greater loss of oysters. There were some, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ed, but there are wild reefs that persisted through all of those struggles in Delaware Bay. And I don't think that's the case in the inland bays. And so what we're trying to do is fully bring back oysters, right? We're basically starting from ground zero, where we don't have oyster habitat. And we also don't really have a robust population of wild oysters to produce baby oysters within our bays. And so the goal of our restoration work is to build the habitat that oysters need to survive, and then also provide the oysters to live on that habitat, with the ultimate goal to be self-sustaining oysters and reefs that in the future we don't have to build and stock, that that they'll continue to do what they do best, which is build on top of one another over multiple generations of oysters.
And so I guess what's the biggest challenges to doing that? Because it sounds like it's definitely a process. It's not something you can flip a switch on. Talk a little bit about the challenge of that process and what kind of hurdles you have to get over to be ultimately, as you said, self-sustaining.
Yeah, so this is something the center has been interested in for quite some time, and we've been working on for much of the last 20 years, I would say, we've been interested in shellfish restoration and oysters specifically. And, you know, we've tried multiple different methods of construction through our adaptive management process. We try to learn from each project and build the next one better. And so we're at a stage now where we're scaling up finally. Mm-hmm. And so we built some smaller scale projects in the past that weren't the most successful in terms of the habitat itself is there, but self-sustaining oyster populations are not something that we were able to achieve. But taking what we learned from those smaller scale projects, we're now moving on to the largest that we've ever built. And so this past fall, we constructed a reef at Pasture Point in Indian River Bay. That reef is built up of four different subunits made mostly of recycled oyster shell that we collect from local restaurants. And it covers a little over 5,000 square feet of underwater bottom in our bays. So far, we've stocked about 16,500 oysters on that reef. We've got room for quite a few more. The two big challenges are building a structure that will be robust enough to survive storms and changing bottom conditions in our bays. And then also the other major challenge is getting enough oysters on the reef to actually reproduce successfully. And so I think the structure side of things, we seem to have sort of cracked the code on a little bit. That's really where I feel like we've learned a lot in the past and that influenced our newest designs. I think actually the oyster recruitment part is still a big, big challenge that we face and something that we're going to continue to work on.
Can you speak, Morgan, a little bit to the overall benefits to the ecosystem that if this does work and a more robust industry can be kind of recreated, like what does that mean in addition to like the commercial side of it? What does it mean for the habitat ecosystem environmental piece of it?
Yeah, so oysters are what we like to call ecosystem engineers. And so what they're doing just by living their lives and building these oyster reefs is not only helping oysters, but helping all of the other organisms in the water. And so obviously that, you know, a main obvious benefit of having oysters in our water is the water filtration side of things. And so oysters can filter in laboratory trials up to 50 gallons of water a day for an adult. In the wild, we estimate it's closer to about 15 gallons of water a day, but still, you know, with hundreds of thousands of oysters in our bays, that's a lot of water that can get filtered on a daily basis. And so that helps with, you know, all the nutrient pollution that we deal with in our bays. And then the habitat that the oysters create through the reef is vital habitat for other organisms in our bays, particularly in their most vulnerable stages of life. And so smaller fish, blue crabs, other invertebrates, all of those organisms need hiding places to make it through those early, very vulnerable stages of their existence. And so the nooks and crannies that the shells of an oyster reef provide are the perfect habitat for a baby blue crab to hide, or for that juvenile tautog that one day will grow up to be something that we could catch and eat. And so not only from an environmental benefit, but also for recreational benefit within our bays and economic benefit to our other fisheries and as a shoreline protection as well.
Ed Hale, this one I want to bring you back in because the state took an interest in this a little over a decade ago. In 2013, they passed legislation to kind of help try to create this aquaculture industry that we're talking about. It seemed like that kind of had a lot of fits and starts along the way. Can you talk a little bit about what has kind of caused that kind of slower rollout of this type of effort and how much of an impact that still has today as things try to ramp up?
Yeah, absolutely. You're accurate, Tom. 2013, Delaware signed legislation that allowed for us to have a shellfish aquaculture industry. I think it's important to note that the state of Delaware is actually engaging in transplant fishery, where we would take oysters from Delaware Bay and place them in the inland bays up until 1979. And so again, it's another one of these things that we're kind of going back to. There's about a four-year rollout after 2013, after the regulations were first written, before we had our initial leasing lottery for shellfish aquaculture development areas. And there was a lot of speculation on as to how that was going to go and what the potential success rate was. And so I think overall there was a lot of prospecting that occurred in that kind of 2017 period. Our first oyster sale occurred in 2018. It was about 9 months after the initial leasing period. Right now, we have somewhere between 10 to 15 individuals or corporations involved with shellfish aquaculture. This includes about 10 farmers in the inland bays, and we think about 4 in Delaware Bay since 2022. There's been a number of potential limitations in terms of the growth of that industry. I think chief among them, we have to consider COVID, right? Like our industry is getting off the ground in 2018, 2 years later, when we expect all these oysters to hit the market, all the restaurants close associated with health standards. And so that has a kind of a crippling economic impact. On top of that, our oyster farmers are competing against well-established operations in Maryland, Virginia, and New Jersey. And so you've kind of set up a hardship for them. Our industry has kind of complained about some of the regulatory burdens. And so recently we completed a legislative task force, which was orchestrated through Delaware, some of our Delaware legislative folks, including Pete Schwarzkopf. And we were trying to get together in a room, you know, the academic folks, the industry folks, and the legislative folks, and say, how can we make this better? When you look at other states, right, like Alaska's promised the potential growth rate. They have an aquaculture growth plan. They have hundreds of millions of dollars, I believe it's hundreds of millions of dollars dedicated to growing an industry, and they're doing it in a faster rate than us. And I think we can take kind of lessons learned and invest in this and do a little bit better job. And so I'm kind of hopeful that the next decade sees a lot of this improvement. I think the things that Morgan talked about in terms of water filtration, habitat creation for ancillary, for other species, the increases in biodiversity, right? Shoreline, potential shoreline protection from erosion, wave attenuation. We know that oyster farming and oyster reefs are beneficial for human-based infrastructure installments. So how do we use these nature-based features to really protect and augment biodiversity while simultaneously using them to create crops and protect shorelines, I think is going to be critical to how we adapt, right, in terms of our coastal living standards.
I did want to ask you, because one of the things that is happening right now, as you mentioned, is this effort to like look at changing and updating state code in this regard. Denrick is seeking public comment and feedback. How important is that process, and how important is hearing from those current license holders and other stakeholders to get this right?
So yeah, absolutely critical, Tom. We need to have our shellfish farmers at the table. What we've learned, you know, since 2013 is that if you make a bunch of regulations and don't engage with the industry that has to go out and do this every day, you're not creating a sustainable, profitable business model. And it's not that our resource agencies need to be, you know, overly concerned about business or operations, but if they want to have a functioning aquaculture industry, you need to actually take the time to meet with the people that are out there doing it and hear their concerns. And if they tell you that something doesn't work, or if they present a valid logical reason for why something doesn't work, actually amend those regulations. And I think that's what we've seen in the legislative task force, is Deneret came to the table, the Delaware Department of Ag came to the table, everybody was there. And that it was a great opportunity for us to kind of get together, put our heads together and say, what works, what doesn't work, and what do we still need?
Morgan, if you want to build on that, what do you see as some of the important next steps that can be taken to really kind of jumpstart this whole process and jumpstart this industry?
You know, like Ed was saying, we're behind other states in the development of this industry and the development of restoration projects as well for oysters. And so I think we're still working out some of the kinks and having these conversations, sitting down with regulators, with farmers for that aquaculture perspective, and with folks who are involved in oyster restoration, right? I'm seeing changes that are really hopeful for me. Things that, you know, as we work to improve the process for the aquaculture side and the permitting process for restoration projects, I think that going forward, you know, it will become easier to carry out these sorts of projects and to, you know, develop these sorts of businesses. And I think that's what we need. We need more open doors and, you know, continuous conversations about how we can all work together to achieve these shared goals.
I guess the one thing that seems clear is that there is a market for this, right? I mean, and I guess specifically, you know, what we know from the efforts to raise oysters and harvest oysters now, that there are like kind of unique attributes to Delaware oysters as opposed to other places. Can you talk a little bit about that there is a certain personality to all this and a market for it that's very specific to Delaware. Go ahead, Morgan.
Yeah, so much like wine has terroir, right? with oysters, we use the term marroir, I believe. And so it's describing, you know, the subtle differences in the different waters that we grow oysters in, particularly the salinity plays a big role. And so I think, you know, depending where you're getting your oysters from, they do have a slightly different flavor to them. You know, if you buy a Delaware Bay oyster, it's going to taste different than an inland bays oyster. And even within the inland bays, you know, different places that you buy oysters from, different farms, because of the different bottom substrates and the type of water that they have there, you'll have a different flavor. And there's different, you know, ways of growing oysters too that can influence that. And so for people who really like oysters, for oyster connoisseurs, it's a really unique opportunity that we have here, situated right here on the water. You know, we can get very fresh product that has a local taste to it, something that you can't get anywhere else.
Ed?
Yeah, I agree. I think in terms of like the local dock-to-table movement, right, with similar application to the farm-to-table movement, there's an interest in localized food production. And oysters certainly kind of fit the bill. As Morgan said, there's a lot of variability associated with where the actual oysters grown, be it at the surface or the bottom or in the inland bays or Delaware Bay, which produces distinct flavor profiles. And a lot of the consumers can actually pick up on that. What's cool is that the Delaware oyster has been ranking fairly highly in terms of taste tests and competitions with other oysters. And so it's exciting to be a part of a project that has a lot of public interest and kind of momentum behind it.
I was going to say, does it have the potential, and maybe this is an imperfect comparison, but like a craft beer industry, right? That there's a real interest, as you said, from connoisseurs to understanding the nuances of different oysters from different places, including a place like Delaware, and within Delaware, the inland bays versus the Delaware Bay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is actually a really good analogy. It's kind of like a craft brewery, and different individuals will market different sizes. They'll market that different taste flavor profile. So we know that they're going to engage in that type of activity, which is kind of, it's fun for us to see that diversification from something that you would think, oh, it's just an oyster. But it turns out that the way you grow it and where you grow it actually has a big impact on that taste.
Morgan, does that have an added level of excitement for you as you're doing these projects to kind of see where all this can go, if you could get it to that point where it is self-sustaining?
Yeah, you know, I guess to be clear, for now, we can't harvest oysters from wild reefs within Delaware. And recreationally, that's not something that's allowed at this point in time. But one day, maybe it could be if we had enough wild oysters out there and if our water quality improved enough. But I think that, you know, partnering with the folks who are growing oysters on these farms provides a great opportunity for us on the restoration side of things. The more farms we can get out there and the more oysters we can get out there, the more places I have to buy oysters for stocking on reefs. And the oysters on those farms, you know, they do much of the same work that the oysters on the reefs do. And so, working together, we are both tackling the same problem.
I want to finish by asking you both, are you optimistic from what you're seeing now that there is that hope of going back to what Ed described early on in terms of the history, that maybe it will not be as big as it was in the late 1800s and into the early 20th century, but that there can be a very robust community and industry surrounding oysters and aquaculture? We'll start with you, Morgan.
Yeah, I am optimistic. I think in general, I've noticed that the public is becoming more aware of the benefits of oysters. And, you know, when we first tried to bring that aquaculture industry back to Delaware, there definitely was some public pushback. But I think now that folks have been on the water with the farmers and the farms have been out there for a while and people can actually taste the product, people are starting to come around. And that helps, you know, our industry, but it also helps restoration projects. There is a trade-off, you know, for any of this work, right? So when we establish areas for oyster farming, when we establish areas for oyster restoration, that's an area that can't necessarily be used for the same recreational activity that it once was. But I think people are starting to understand the importance of that trade-off and that it's worth it to, you know, put something in the water that maybe means I can't drive my boat there, but it might mean that when I'm boating in other areas, the water's that much clearer and the fishing's that much better.
Ed, we'll finish with you. Your level of optimism.
It's pretty high. I mean, ecotourism and the bays in general, as Morgan said, they're worth, you know, millions of dollars in terms of the state economic opportunity. And I think when you look at oysters, you know, you can look at oysters from the the CIB side for restoration projects, and you can look at it from farming. From the farming aspect, it's the most lucrative marine cultured organism nationally, and it's growing regionally. We haven't hit a saturation point, and so I'm really hopeful that we kind of continue to grow and build on the successes that we've had. We've learned a lot of hard lessons, and I'm hopeful that the next 10 years is a little bit more of an expansion period and a little bit more favorable. And I'm kind of excited to see that. Every time I go out, I'm looking, trying to figure out who's got a local oyster for sale. That's something I take pride in. And I think, you know, Morgan and I work together for restoration efforts and farming projects. And so it's something I think that everybody within the community can actually get on board with.
You've been listening to a portion of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet, with Ed Hale, assistant professor in the School of Marine Science and Policy and the Delaware Sea Grant Program at the University of Delaware, and Morgan Krell, science technician at the Delaware Center for the Inland Bays. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. People and Planet is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, the staff at Delaware Humanities, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny and Sarah Petrowich, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.